in their plasmids. The plasmid may then float in its new host, or it may paste itself into the chromosome. Horizontal inheritance may seem bizarre, but it happens all around us. It even happens inside us. An experiment carried out in 2004 by a team of Danish scientists showed how a species called Enterococcus faecium horizontally inherits DNA within our own bodies. Over the past few thousand years, the species has evolved into strains that colonize the human gut and skin, and others that prefer living in animals. Most strains of E. faecium are harmless, but some can cause potentially fatal infections in the blood and bladder. The standard treatment for an E. faecium infection is a dose of antibiotics. There was a time when that treatment always got the job done. But by the early 2000s, E. faecium had evolved into a medical nightmare. More and more often, doctors found that the bacteria carried genes that allowed them to resist drugs. When a resistant strain takes hold in a patient, the bacteria multiply without check, passing down their resistance genes vertically to their descendants. In 2004, half a dozen brave souls agreed to drink 2 cups of milk. In the first cup were 1 billion Enterococcus faecium. They belonged to a strain isolated from humans and could be easily killed by an antibiotic called vancomycin. 3 hours later, the 6 volunteers drank a 2nd cup containing another 1 billion E. faecium that came from chickens, carrying a gene that made them resistant to vancomycin. This milk drinking was part of an experiment at Denmark's National Center for Antimicrobials and Infection Control. Over the following month, the Danish scientists collected stool samples from the 6 subjects and surveyed them for the 2 strains of E. faecium. The chicken strain quickly became rare and then disappeared after a few days. The human strain, better adapted to its new home, lasted longer. But in 3 of the 6 subjects, the scientists found that the human strain had changed. Now each generation of bacteria passed down a new gene they didn't have at the beginning of the experiment. They inherited the chicken strain's gene for vancomycin resistance. Microbes can even inherit genes horizontally from their greatest enemies, viruses. Viruses, protein shells containing genes, have a form of heredity distinct from that of cellular life. A virus does not reproduce by copying its own genes and dividing in 2. Instead, it invades a host cell. A virus that attacks bacteria, known as a bacteriophage, typically lands on the cell wall of a host and injects its DNA inside, like shooting a piece of spaghetti out of a syringe. Bacteria have several ways of recognizing this DNA and destroying it, but none of them are foolproof. If the virus's genes survive long enough, they commandeer the cell. The cell makes proteins from some of the virus's genes, which then drive the cell to make new viruses, complete with new copies of the original virus's genes. When it comes to viruses, heredity is almost an abstraction. They have no material bond to their ancestors, since all the atoms in a new virus come from the host cell where it formed. For viruses, heredity is an invisible thread of information joining one virus to its progeny. As viral genes get packaged into new viruses, sometimes things go awry. A gene from their microbial host may get swept up inside a viral shell. The new viruses that leave the microbe carry that host gene with their own, and they may later inject it into a new host. In some cases, the microbial gene may end up in its new host's chromosome. Viruses can thus act like accidental fairies, transporting microbial genes from one organism to another, sometimes even moving them between species. As scientists examine microbes more closely, they have discovered still more strange forms of heredity. One particularly weird kind of microbial inheritance came to light in the early 2000s as scientists were investigating how bacteria fight against viruses. It turns out that when many species of microbes are exposed to a new virus, they can learn how to stage a swift, precise attack against it. Vertebrate animals like ourselves have the same capacity. When we get attacked by influenza or a cold virus, our immune system can build antibodies that will wipe these strains out as soon as they try to attack us again. Bacteria can't use an immune system made up of billions of cells. Each microbe is one cell that has to fend for itself. But they manage this feat all on their own, using a system of molecules called CRISPR-Cas. When viruses infect bacteria, they typically land on their victim and inject a string of DNA inside. Many microbes can chop off the tip of this incoming DNA and insert it into a stretch of its own DNA, called a CRISPR region. CRISPR is short for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. If microbes manage to survive this initial attack from a virus, they will be equipped to resist the next one. They prepare for a subsequent infection by building a short RNA molecule that matches the bit of viral DNA they grabbed from the first attack. A protein called a Cas enzyme folds itself around the RNA molecule, and the two together float off through the cell. If the same strain of virus tries to inject its DNA into the microbe, the CRISPR-Cas system latches on to the incoming genes. The Cas enzyme pulls the viral DNA strands apart and chops them into pieces. Shredded into harmless debris, the virus cannot take over the microbe. As a microbe battles virus after virus, it may store away samples from a dozen of its enemies. And when it divides, it passes down this accumulated knowledge to its descendants. When a microbe copies its chromosome, it copies its CRISPR region along with the rest of its DNA. August Weismann's germline barrier may prevent the experiences of animals from altering their germ cells. But for bacteria, no such barrier exists. In a sense, soma and germ are bound up in a single cell. Some scientists have argued that CRISPR is a genuine case of Lamarckian heredity. Of course, virus-fighting bacteria are a far cry from the leaf-plucking giraffes of Lamarck's imagination, and so the question can descend into a squabble over semantics. What's indisputably clear, however, is with CRISPR, scientists have found yet another channel of heredity beyond Mendel's law. About 1.8 billion years ago, a new form of life evolved on Earth. Its cells were much larger than those of bacteria and archaea. Its DNA was tucked with exquisite care inside a pouch called the nucleus. It generated abundant amounts of fuel in special pods called mitochondria. Among the many forms this new kind of life would take would be our own. These microbial monsters were eukaryotes. Their descendants would give rise to protozoans, the predators of the microbial world that hunt through soil and sea for single-celled prey. Eukaryotes evolved into all multicellular life on Earth as well, including fungi, plants, and animals like us. Along with their nucleus and large size, eukaryotes share many other traits that bacteria and archaea lack. But one of those traits matters most to heredity. Eukaryotes pass down their genes to their offspring in a unique way, one that allowed Mendel's law to emerge. While bacteria and archaea have a single chromosome, eukaryotes carry pairs of them. Different species have different numbers of pairs. We humans have 23 pairs, but pea plants have only 7. Yeast have 16. Some butterflies have 134. When our somatic cells divide, they copy all their chromosomes, creating an extra pair for each one. They tear down the nucleus, pull half the chromosomes to each side, and split themselves down the middle. Each new cell now has its own 23 pairs. This kind of division, called mitosis, is fundamentally similar to what bacteria do, turn one cell into two identical cells. Our bodies use mitosis to grow and rejuvenate themselves. But in order to make germ cells, we have to make sperm or eggs that have only one set of chromosomes, rather than a pair. The simplest way to make sperm and eggs would be to simply pull apart the pairs of chromosomes in a somatic cell and allot one set to each germ cell. But our bodies do not do that. Instead, they indulge in a process called meiosis, which is laughably baroque. In men, meiosis takes place within a labyrinth of tubes coiled within the testicles. The tube walls are lined with sperm precursor cells, each carrying two copies of each chromosome, one from the man's mother, the other from his father. When these cells divide, they copy all their DNA, so that now they have four copies of each chromosome. Rather than drawing apart from each other, however, the chromosomes stay together. A maternal and paternal copy of each chromosome line up alongside each other. Proteins descend on them and slice the chromosomes, making cuts at precisely the same spots. As the cell repairs these self-inflicted wounds, a remarkable exchange can take place. A piece of DNA from one chromosome may get moved to the same position in the other, its own place taken by its counterpart. This molecular surgery cannot be rushed. All told, a cell may need 3 weeks to finish meiosis. Once it's done, its chromosomes pull away from each other. The cell then divides twice to make 4 new sperm cells. Each of the 4 cells inherits a single copy of all 23 chromosomes, but each sperm cell contains a different assembly of DNA. One source of this difference comes from how the pairs of chromosomes get separated. A sperm might contain the version of chromosome 1 that a man inherited from his father, chromosome 2 from his mother, and so on. Another sperm might have a different combination. At the same time, some chromosomes in a sperm are hybrids. Thanks to meiosis, a sperm cell's copy of chromosome 1 might be a combination of DNA from both his mother and father. The basic biology of meiosis is the same inside a woman's body, but the timing is very different. The first steps take place while she's still an embryo in her mother's womb. A group of cells inside a female embryo take on a new identity as egg precursors, moving together to where the ovaries will later develop. When the embryo is 7 months old, the precursor cells begin meiosis, doubling their chromosomes, pairing some of them together, and exchanging some pieces of DNA. But the chromosomes then freeze in place midway through meiosis. They stay that way for years until girls reach adolescence and start to ovulate. During each ovulatory cycle, a single egg precursor turns on its meiosis and completes the cycle. As with sperm, a woman's meiosis produces 4 new cells, each with only 23 chromosomes. But only one of those cells matures into an egg. The other 3 cells wither down to vestiges, known as polar bodies. Scientists can now see how meiosis drove the patterns that Mendel observed in his garden. When Mendel crossed tall and short pea plants, for example, he grew hybrids that were all tall. But when he crossed them, a quarter of the next generation turned out short again. Now scientists know the genes responsible for those differences. Known as LE, it makes a protein that triggers peas to grow. His short pea plants carried 2 copies of a mutant form of the LE gene. The LE proteins in these plants didn't work properly, stopping their growth. The hybrids had 1 working copy of LE, which was enough to grow normally. When a hybrid pea plant matured, some of its cells went through meiosis before producing pollen and ovules. The cells duplicated their chromosomes, shuffled some genes from one chromosome to its partner, and then pulled them apart into 4 sets. It was a matter of chance whether a pollen grain ended up with the chromosome carrying the normal version of the LE gene or the mutant form. As a result, half the germ cells produced by each pea plant had each copy of the gene. The biologist Lawrence Hurst once wrote that meiosis takes place in a manner reminiscent of drunkards returning from an evening's revelry, 1 step backwards, 2 steps forward. Yet this strange stumbling is also responsible for heredity's most elegant patterns. Scientists first spotted chromosomes in the mid-1800s, but meiosis didn't come to light until decades later. In the early 1900s, a Belgian priest named Frans Alphonse Janssens stained fertilized salamander eggs so that he could observe their chromosomes through a microscope. The stains captured them at different stages of meiosis, like frames from a movie. It looked to Janssens as if the chromosomes were intimately interacting with each other and then pulling apart. In the brief report he published on his discovery in 1909, Janssens didn't try to draw any profound lessons about heredity. But he had a hunch it would turn out to be important. "Are we being presumptuous?" Janssens asked. "Time will tell." It didn't take much time at all. While Janssens was peering at salamander cells in Belgium, Thomas Hunt Morgan was breeding white-eyed flies in New York. Morgan and his colleagues first discovered that the hereditary factor for red or white eyes was located on a chromosome. Today we'd say that the gene for eye color is a stretch of DNA on the chromosome. Morgan's team also found another factor, which produced short wings on flies, on the same chromosome. Because that chromosome happened to be the X, Morgan and his colleagues could study these factors by breeding flies. They took advantage of the fact that males have 1 X chromosome and 1 Y, while females have 2 X's. Morgan and his students used breeding to produce female flies with both white eyes and short wings. One of their X chromosomes carried the factor for white eyes in flies, while the other carried the one for short wings. Then the scientists bred these females with red-eyed males. The sons of these female flies inherited only one X chromosome, all getting it from their mother. It was thus no surprise to the scientists that some of the sons had red eyes, while others had short wings. But Morgan and his students also found something extraordinary. A few sons ended up with white eyes and short wings. A few other sons developed red eyes and long wings. The X chromosomes of their mothers were trading hereditary factors, creating new combinations of traits. In later studies, Morgan's team showed they could also take two factors sitting on the same chromosome and split them apart. They reared flies in which the same X chromosome carried the factors for short wings and a yellow body. Sons that inherited that particular chromosome from their mother developed both traits. When Morgan's team bred those flies, however, a fraction of sons ended up with yellow bodies but normal-sized wings. Others had normal bodies with short wings. Morgan didn't quite know how to make sense of these results at first. By good fortune, he happened to stumble across Janssen's report. He realized that Janssen had unwittingly found the physical solution to his own experiments. Morgan and his colleagues quickly wrote up a new hypothesis that combined both sets of results. Each chromosome, they argued, carried a set of factors arrayed in a line like beads on a string. When female flies developed their eggs, their X chromosomes crossed over each other and traded segments. The joining and splitting of traits happened only rarely, but Morgan and his students noticed that they occurred with striking regularity. A particular trait might get split from a second one in 1% of offspring, but it might get split from a third trait 2% of the time. Morgan's student Alfred Sturtevant realized that the reason for this puzzling pattern had to do with where genes sat on their chromosomes. When chromosomes get broken into segments during meiosis, the genes that are close to each other tend to stay on the same segments. Distant genes are more likely to get separated. If someone starts ripping dictionaries apart at random places and handing you the pieces, you can bet that the chunk that contains meiosis will be more likely to contain mitosis than chromosome. Sturtevant's insight led the way to genetic maps, which marked how far apart genes were from each other. Heredity now gained a geography. Time and again, the principles of heredity that Morgan's group discovered in flies proved true in other species. Meiosis was no exception. We humans, along with other animals, also turned out to be the products of meiosis. The slimy kelp beating in the tides carry out meiosis too, as do groves of bamboo clattering in the wind and stinkhorns heaving out of the ground. While scientists have put forward a number of explanations for why meiosis evolved, one has gained a lot of evidence in recent years. Meiosis lets evolution do its job better. Consider what meiosis does inside of one of Morgan's Drosophila flies. Like other flies, it has a collection of traits. Let's say those traits include short wings, a strong immune response, and the ability to make lots of eggs. And let's say the genes for those three traits, one bad and two good, all sit on the same chromosome. Without meiosis, that fly would only be able to pass down its three alleles in one bundle, since the three genes all sit on the same chromosome. What's more, if any new harmful mutations arose on that chromosome in later generations, it would also get passed down along with the other alleles. Over the generations, the fly's descendants would sink under a burden of bad mutations. Give the fly meiosis, and everything changes. Its descendants are no longer doomed to inherit a particular combination of alleles on each chromosome. Meiosis shuffles the alleles into new combinations. Some of the fly's descendants may inherit the alleles for frail wings and a weak immune system, but meiosis also allows other descendants to end up with powerful wings and a strong immune system. These stronger flies can reproduce, and their offspring will sustain the population into future generations. The population of flies ends up with combinations of superior genetic variants, while many harmful mutations disappear into oblivion. Michael Desai, a biologist at Harvard, tested this idea by staging a competition among yeast. He chose these single-celled fungi for their flexibility when it comes to reproducing. Yeast can either clone themselves or have sex. To clone itself, a yeast cell grows a bud that bulges from its cell wall. It copies its chromosomes and stuffs the new copies into the bud, which can then break off to become a cell of its own. Sometimes yeast have sex instead. The strain Desai studied exists in two so-called mating types, known as A and alpha. each type releases a chemical that lures yeast of the other type. The A and alpha cells approach each other and fuse into one. The merged cell, which now contains a double set of chromosomes, can then multiply into new cells. But if it runs out of food, it responds by carrying out meiosis between its A and alpha chromosomes. The yeast cell partners its chromosomes together and shuffles DNA. It then separates its chromosomes into two sets, each of which gets stored inside a spore. Those tough-coated spores can drift away, taking their mixed-up genes to a better place where they may be able to grow again. In his experiment, Desai allowed some of his yeast to have sex every 90 generations. The rest of the yeast could only clone themselves. Desai let the clones and the sexual yeast compete in test tubes for food. Sometimes new mutations arose that made a yeast cell do better than the rest of the population, allowing it to produce more offspring. For 1,000 generations, Desai and his colleagues kept track of how each group of yeast fared in the evolutionary race. The differences between yeasts that could have sex and those that couldn't were clear. Sometimes a beneficial mutation would arise in the cloning yeast, letting them reproduce faster than the clones that lacked it. But along with that good mutation, the clones passed down bad mutations. The yeasts that Desai allowed to have sex could separate good mutations from bad ones, thanks to meiosis. And when more good mutations emerged, meiosis was able to bring them together in new combinations to produce even better yeast. At the end of the experiment, the yeast that could have sex had evolved to grow much faster than the clones. This ancient shuffling is the answer to some of the most common questions about heredity. When Grace gave birth to our second daughter, Veronica, we watched her grow and wondered how much she would turn out like her older sister, Charlotte. After all, they had the same parents, meaning that they had inherited DNA from the same two genomes. They were raised in the same house, eating the same food. But Charlotte and Veronica turned out to be far from clones. Charlotte is luminously pale, with freckles, greenish eyes, and strawberry blonde hair. Veronica has a deeper tone to her skin and mahogany-colored irises. Charlotte grew to 5'6", a fairly average height. Veronica has always been off the charts, making people assume she's a couple of years older than she really is. As a child, Charlotte would hold back when we introduced her to new people, sizing them up. Veronica, standing next to her, would launch herself into the air and shout her name. At age 12, Charlotte became obsessed with galaxies and dark matter. Veronica didn't care much what the universe is made of. She'd rather sing or read Jane Austen. The experiences our daughters have had probably account for some of their differences, but so does meiosis. Grace and I gave each of our children different combinations of the DNA we inherited from our own parents. The unique combination of alleles that each of our children ended up with had a unique influence on how she grew up. Yet meiosis also works in strange ways that defy our intuitions. Parents pass down one copy of each chromosome to each child. Which chromosome is inherited is a 50-50 matter of chance. The DNA in any pair of siblings, statistics would suggest, should be 50% genetically identical. Identical twins, by contrast, are 100% identical, because they are the product of a single fertilized egg. First cousins, who have only one set of grandparents in common, are on average 12.5% genetically identical. All this is true, but only on average. It's just as true to say that if you roll a pair of dice, they'll turn up close to a 7. Yet if any particular roll may still turn up snake eyes. After meiosis shuffles DNA between chromosomes, it's possible for a woman's eggs to end up with more DNA from her father than her mother, or vice versa. Two siblings might arise from eggs that happen to have more DNA from their maternal grandmother than their maternal grandfather. The reverse may be true for other siblings. Meiosis can thus make two siblings more genetically similar to each other than to the rest of their siblings. The ability to read DNA allowed scientists to measure this genetic similarity in real people. In 2006, Peter Vischer, a geneticist at the Queensland Institute of Medical Research in Australia, and his colleagues studied 4,401 pairs of siblings, examining several hundred genetic markers in each volunteer. The siblings often had a series of identical genetic markers along a chromosome, segments they inherited from one of their parents. On average, they found about half of the DNA in the siblings was made up of these identical stretches. But many of the siblings deviated from a perfect 50%. At the high end, the researchers found a pair of siblings who shared 61.7% of their DNA. At the low end was a pair of siblings who shared only 37.4%. Along the spectrum of inheritance, in other words, some of our siblings are more like our identical twins, others more like cousins. Once Mendel's so-called laws evolved in the first eukaryotes, they passed them down to their descendants. It has endured in most of the lineages even till today. Nearly 2 billion years later, tarantulas use meiosis to mix chromosomes and shuffle genes. So do hummingbirds, roses, and deathcap mushrooms. But for all the enduring advantages that meiosis may offer, under the right circumstances, it can fade and vanish. In thousands of species of plants, for example, meiosis has crumbled away. Their ovules do not develop from precursor cells shuffling the DNA and then pulling apart pairs of chromosomes. Instead, these plants can produce ovules through a fairly ordinary division of cells. Mother cells with pairs of chromosomes produce daughter cells with precisely the same pairs. Although these plants evolved a way to give up meiosis, they still cling to some vestiges of their history as sexual species. They can develop their ovules only if pollen grains settle on their flowers and deliver the right molecular signals. But all they need from the pollen are these signals. They make no use of the male DNA. One of these odd plants happens to be hawkweed, the plant Mendel chose to study as a follow-up to peas. His peas reliably carried out meiosis, producing a 3-to-1 ratio of dominant and recessive traits. It was his bad luck to then pick hawkweed, a plant that had evolved away from that sort of heredity, to search for those same ratios. When Mendel painted pollen onto hawkweed flowers, he usually triggered them to make seeds containing an identical copy of their own DNA, and taking in none of the DNA from the pollen. Only after geneticists learned to trace the path of genes from one generation of hawkweed to the next did they realize Mendel's great misfortune. Plants and other eukaryotes lose meiosis when the evolutionary benefits no longer outweigh the costs. In certain situations, organisms can reproduce more successfully if they simply duplicate their own DNA rather than combine them with the opposite sex and break apart the links between their genes. But there are other ways for them to break Mendel's law as well. Sometimes individual genes take over heredity for their own evolutionary benefit. These molecular hackers first came to light in the 1920s with the discovery of flies with too many daughters. A Russian biologist named Sergei Gershenson went into a forest to trap a species of fly called Drosophila obscura. When he brought the flies back to the Institute of Experimental Biology in Moscow, he figured out how to keep them alive on a diet of fermented raisins, potatoes, and water. Some of the female flies he trapped were carrying fertilized eggs, which they then laid by the thousands. Gershenson picked some of their offspring to breed new lines he could study for inherited traits. There was something peculiar about two of the lines, Gershenson noticed. Typically, a batch of eggs produced by Drosophila obscura contains an even balance of males and females. But in two of Gershenson's lines, the mothers tended to produce far more daughters than sons. Sometimes they had no sons at all. The ratios were so extreme, Gershenson said, that it seemed impossible to explain them by accidental causes. To find the true cause, Gershenson carried out a series of breeding experiments. The penchant for daughters could be passed down like a simple genetically encoded trait. Eventually, Gershenson figured out that it was determined by a gene on the X chromosome. But he couldn't understand how the gene tilted the balance away from sons and toward daughters. Whatever its particular trick might be, Gershenson realized it had slipped through a loophole in Mendel's law. Flies normally have a 50% chance of becoming male or female, because sperm have a 50% chance of acquiring an X or a Y chromosome. As a result, a normal gene on the X chromosome will end up in about half of a male fly's offspring. In Gershenson's flies, on the other hand, the math is different. If a male fly carried the mysterious mutation he discovered, most, or even all, of his offspring inherited his X chromosome. Few, if any, inherited his Y. Those flies could then pass the daughter-producing gene down to their own offspring. Overall, the odds of flies inheriting the daughter-favoring mutation would be much higher than 50%. As a result, it would become more common in a population. This, Gershenson concluded, favors its extension. At first, Gershenson's discovery might have seemed like an oddball exception to the rules of heredity, but it didn't take long for scientists to find other cases where genes were fixing Mendel's dice in their own favor. Collectively, these violations came to be known as gene drive. Gene drive is so powerful that it can spread a gene like an intergenerational epidemic until it dominates an entire population. Today, the gene drive catalog has many entries, not just in flies, but in plants, fungi, mammals, and, perhaps, even humans. In some cases, a gene drive spreads itself by encoding a toxin. Sperm cells carrying it make the toxin, which then spreads to other sperm. The other sperm die, unless they have the gene drive element, which also contains an antidote to the toxin. In other cases, the gene drive waits until male embryos start developing before switching on and killing them. Gene drive can break Mendel's law in females, too. When a precursor egg cell develops, it divides into four cells. One becomes the egg, while the other three become polar bodies. In other words, three reproductive dead ends. A given copy of a gene normally has a 50-50 chance of ending up in the egg rather than in a polar body. Some genes have evolved the ability to manipulate those odds. They're more likely to end up in the egg, and thus to get passed down to future generations of daughters. With so much evidence for the power of gene drive among other eukaryotes, it stands to reason that we might be subject to it as well. But the evidence for cheating on Mendel is still unclear in humans. It's not surprising that it would be hard to study gene drive in our own species. Scientists can breed flies and fungi, inspecting every step of reproduction to catch gene drive in the act. When it comes to humans, geneticists must make the best of uncontrolled history. The most obvious sign of a human gene drive would be a human version of what Gershenson observed, families full of daughters. But the relatively small size of human families makes it hard to know if such families are the result of gene drive. Just because I have two daughters doesn't mean Grace and I might not have had sons if we had 10 children. One way to search for it in humans is to step back from individual families and combine thousands of them into one big analysis. Even if each family is relatively small, they can add up to a horde of people big enough to let scientists distinguish between chance and drive. Some of those databases include genetic markers. It should be possible to find some genetic markers that are passed down from parents to children more often than you'd expect based on Mendel alone. While the concept is sound, scientists are struggling to get a clear picture of gene drive in our species. A few promising genes have turned up in recent studies, but when scientists have tried to replicate those studies in other groups of people, they have not found an effect. It's possible that we need to wait for more accurate and detailed DNA sequences before scientists can find a clear sign of gene drive rampaging through our species. It's also possible that our ancestors were besieged by gene drives, but overcame them. Gene drives are short-sighted in their victory. They can sweep quickly through a population, but in the process they can put a species at grave risk. If a gene kills off sperm with Y chromosomes, males can become dangerously rare in a population. More and more females never encounter a male in their life and die without offspring. The population shrinks and then collapses. In some cases, it may take just a few dozen generations for a gene drive to push a population to extinction. While gene drive extinctions can theoretically happen, no one has yet seen one unfold in the wild. Many gene drives may fall short of total oblivion because organisms evolve defenses against them. Animals and plants will sometimes evolve special RNA molecules that can interfere with gene drives, blocking the production of new proteins. Mutations may then disable gene drives, rendering the defenses no longer necessary. The genes for these defenses may mutate as well. Yet even after millions of years, the vestiges of these defenses can still be recognized. It turns out our own genome is littered with relics of this conflict. Even if gene drives are not exploiting us today, they have been an important part of our history. And today we inherit the genetic scars of ancient struggle. What Mendel discovered was not a law, so much as a battleground. Chapter 6, The Sleeping Branches. I doubt many children give much thought to meiosis, but there comes a point early in the life of all children when they realize that they weren't simply brought into existence by their parents. They get up on their toes and peer beyond their mother and father, back into their genealogical past. They realize that their parents have parents of their own, who have parents too, and so on, back along family branches that stretch over memory's horizon. They realize all those ancestors are part of the reason they are alive. They wonder what would have happened if one great-great-great-grandmother decided to turn down the marriage proposal of a great-great-great-grandfather. Somehow, through an improbable flow of heredity down merging streams, they all converged on one baffled child. I can remember my own first bafflement. When I interrogated my parents about their ancestry, I was amazed at how quickly they ran out of answers. My father, who was born in 1944 in Newark, told me about his parents. William Zimmer had been a doctor, and Evelyn Rader a librarian. They were both Reform Jews and dedicated socialists who played Paul Robeson records around the house when my father was a boy. It took me years to notice those Robeson 78s tucked away on a shelf in my parents' house. Those licorice slabs are among the few points of contact I have ever had with my paternal grandparents. My grandfather died when my father was 3, my grandmother the summer before he went to college. I never got to see them get into a Passover argument about politics with their son, who turned Republican in college and later became a congressman. When I pushed my father to tell me about my older ancestors, his genealogical knowledge sputtered out quickly, leaving me with a blurry origin story that put his ancestors somewhere in the neighborhood of Germany or Ukraine or somewhere in between. My mother came from Schicksalsstock, a German-Irish Catholic mother, Mary Lou Pohl, and an English Protestant father, Harrison LeGrand Goodspeed Jr. Her parents met at a tennis match as teenagers growing up in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Things then moved fast, as they often did in the 1940s. My grandfather, whom everyone called Peter, converted to Catholicism, married Mary Lou, headed off to Germany to fight Nazis, and then returned a year later to his wife and daughter, my mother. They went on to have 3 more children, whom they raised in a world of optimistic little businesses, tidy bowling lanes, tipsy games of bridge, and endless rounds of golf. The first time my father stepped aboard a commercial airplane was to fly to Michigan to marry my mother at her parents' house in 1965. It must have felt like an alien planet to him. To the Goodspeeds, the 21-year-old Jew from New Jersey may well have seemed like an extraterrestrial. I was fortunate to know my mother's parents for several decades, but beyond them, the maternal line dims as well. On the Pole side, my great-grandparents died in the 50s, leaving behind only vague tales of sadness and early death. Harrison Goodspeed's father, on the other hand, lived long enough to give me a purple toy car for an early birthday, and to puzzle me by disappearing from life. I never met my great-grandmother Dorothy Rankin. What little I know of her comes from 2 photographs. In one, she poses in a flapper dress and necklaces. On the back of the picture, she scribbled a note to someone back in Michigan, explaining how grand Paris is. In the other picture, she stands in a shady front yard next to my great-grandfather, cradling my grandfather. Dorothy Rankin died a few months after that picture was taken. In her 30s, my mother began investigating our ancestors, leading us on trips to rub gravestones in old New England cemeteries. Seeing her interest in the family history, my great-grandfather decided she should inherit a book of his about the family, published in 1907. One day, the old leather volume appeared on a shelf in our living room. History of the Goodspeed Family, profusely illustrated, being a genealogical and narrative record extending from 1380 to 1906, and embracing material concerning the family collected during 18 years of research, together with maps, plates, charts, etc. 1380. I was binge-reading Lord of the Rings at the time. Seeing my genealogy pushed into the Middle Ages felt like gaining citizenship in Gondor. When my mother explained to me that the name Goodspeed came from the early English exclamation Godspeed, I saw knights bidding each other well as they rode off to fight orcs. When I got around to dipping into history of the Goodspeed family, my medieval ancestors didn't live up to my hopes. The Goodspeeds first appear in the historical record in 1380, when one John Godspeed was sued, touching a trespass. In 1385, another Godspeed failed to pay a debt. In 1396, Robert Godspeed killed a man named John Archibald, but was pardoned out of regard for Good Friday. The author of History of the Godspeed Family, a distant cousin named Weston Arthur Godspeed, downplayed our family's criminal debut. All of these offenses, except the one causing the death of John Archibald, were trivial and would have no standing in the courts of today, except in civil suits, Weston sniffed. I could imagine him then giving a careless shrug, adding, "Besides, does anybody really miss John Archibald?" In his 18 years of research, Weston Godspeed looked hard for signs of nobility. He found nothing. A thorough examination of the English books on peerage fails to reveal the name Godspeed, he admitted. To those of our great family who will regard this as a serious social blow, the author of this volume extends his profound pity, sympathy, and commiseration. But what did that really matter, Weston asked, since all of the coats of arms displayed by American families were fake? Some were fictitious or fraudulent, he declared. Some were even ludicrous in their pretensions. The Godspeeds should be proud of their humble origins, of the fact that the original Godspeed who came to America, my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather Roger Godspeed, was just a yeoman. The undoubted respectability and sterling qualities of the English yeomanry may be considered in democratic America as far superior to a coat of arms thus bought and unearned, Weston declared. Roger Godspeed was born in 1615 in Wingrave, England, and sailed to Massachusetts in his early 20s. There's no evidence that he took the journey as a Puritan fleeing persecution. He merely wished, like thousands of others, to improve his surroundings, and America seemed to offer the best opportunity, Weston wrote. Roger Goodspeed's name first pops up in historical records in 1639 as one of the first farmers to settle in Barnstable, a town on Cape Cod. A decade later, he built a new farmhouse a few miles away on the bank of the Herring River, which came to be known as Goodspeed's River. There he lived till his death in 1685. Over the course of his entire life, Roger Godspeed made only a few ripples in written history, accusing a neighbor of stealing a goat, signing his will with a single letter, R. Roger Godspeed had three daughters and four sons. They inherited his DNA and his name. Later, they also inherited his bridles and saddles, his trenchers, and his spinning wheel. They bore him 22 grandchildren, and in later generations his descendants spread through the colonies and then across the United States. About 250 years after Roger Goodspeed's arrival in Massachusetts, Weston Goodspeed started gathering information about his descendants, writing letters to relatives and searching archives, and eventually amassed biographical details on 2,429 Goodspeeds. History of the Godspeed Family ended up stretching to 561 pages, but Weston didn't treat it as the last word. It was supposed to be the opening salvo of a long campaign. Weston catalogued only American Godspeeds through the male line. He promised to add the female branches in a future edition. He even dreamed the book would inspire yearly Godspeed conventions. It is the intention to call the first General Assembly of the Godspeeds, he declared, for the purpose of effecting an organization which, thereafter, it is hoped, will be permanent, will hold annual meetings, will continue the publication of these records in the future, and will take any other steps that shall be in the interest of the family and agreeable to all. The Godspeed meetings never came to pass, nor did Weston ever expand the family tree. The scraps of information that survive about Weston suggest a life marinated in disappointment. He worked at a small publishing company run by his brothers until it shut down near the end of the 1800s. The 1900 census listed Weston Godspeed as unmarried and unemployed at age 48. 7 years later, he published History of the Godspeed Family, and by 1910, the census showed he had moved to a Chicago boarding house run by a widow. Weston died in 1926, at age 74, without producing a new volume of his genealogy, not to mention any heir to the Godspeed name. I still sometimes take the History of the Godspeed Family down from the shelf on visits back home. Scanning its parade of wills, court records, and inventories of children, I puzzle about the genealogical drive that propelled its creation, the force that made Weston spend a large fraction of his time on Earth building a catalog of 2,429 people, people who were mostly unaware of one another. Weston left a clue at the beginning of his book. He dedicated it to the rapid, symmetrical, and beautiful growth of the family tree, to the avoidance of all windstorms likely to damage the orchard, to the eradication of the insects of ignorance and immorality certain to contaminate the fruit, to the transplantation of buds and scions in all agreeable soils, to the awakening of the sleeping branches to bright foliage and sweet blossoms, and to plenteous harvests of golden children grown in the sunshine of love, liberty, and law. Weston saw himself as a naturalist, in other words. He was describing an organism that extended itself seamlessly through the United States, a tree of heredity that sprouted from Roger Goodspeed, the Adam to all American Goodspeeds. Yet Weston didn't do a very good job of showing what, if anything, binds the branches of the Goodspeed tree together, what made that tree a thing worth documenting in such painstaking detail. The Goodspeeds had no crown to pass down from king to prince, realigning the world along the way. We're not Rockefellers, with a vast fortune carried down through generations. In all honesty, American history would not have been any different if Roger Goodspeed's ship sank halfway across the Atlantic. As far as I can tell, Weston believed what bound the Goodspeed family together, what he believed was inherited by every new generation, was goodness. A number of Goodspeed men fought in the Civil War, not as generals or colonels, granted, but as valiant Union Army soldiers nonetheless. The splendid military record of these men will ever be a heritage of pride and glory for all who bear the family name, Weston declared. Of course, it would be hard to find a family in the United States in the 1860s that didn't send some sons to war. Having never served in the military myself, I don't see how I'm entitled to bask in that heritage of Civil War bravery. Most Goodspeeds didn't fight in wars, but Weston still found some goodness in them as well. Francis Goodspeed, Weston wrote, even as a boy, was broad-minded and loved his books. John F. Goodspeed was engaged in the furniture business. He devised Goodspeed's superior polish. Seymour Goodspeed has accumulated a comfortable competence, reared a large family to correct and useful lives, is passing a clean and honorable career, and has the respect of all who know him. Thomas Goodspeed has never failed to vote at state and national elections. Of one family of Goodspeeds, Weston simply noted, all became good citizens. Not long ago, I discovered that Google put history of the Goodspeed family online. I decided to play a game, seeing if I could find any keywords of a scandal. I tried murder, bribery, illegitimate, alcohol. I have yet to win. At best, I can only find faint shadows cast across the inherent goodness of Goodspeeds. Ryland Goodspeed, born in 1841, became the manager of a California ranch, an immense and beautiful ranch, of course. Eventually, he fell in love with the owner's daughter, a gifted and most fascinating woman, of course. Then Cousin Weston gets cryptic. Ryland and his wife got married under romantic circumstances and after several notable escapades. As for the rest of the marriage, Weston simply noted that after many years they were divorced, largely upon whimsical grounds. Compare the unblemished saga of the Goodspeeds with the Kallikak family, which Henry Goddard published only 5 years later. They're both quintessentially American expressions of our beliefs about heredity. Goddard envisioned a pure line of crime and feeble-mindedness. Weston presented a pedigree of middling Protestant prosperity. While Goddard envisioned some Mendelian factor poisoning the Wolvertons, Weston Goodspeed seems to have believed that the Goodspeeds inherited a moral factor, perhaps acquiring it from their parents among the lessons they got about democracy and furniture polish. The American obsession with genealogy was caused by a case of transoceanic amnesia. Roger Goodspeed, born and raised in 17th century England, was steeped in traditional European customs for remembering ancestors. The Bible's genealogies linked Jesus by blood back to the Old Testament patriarchs. Kings and noblemen justified their power with hereditary chains linking them back to the mythic past. William the Conqueror's genealogy reached all the way back to the warriors of ancient Troy. By the Renaissance, rich merchants were hiring genealogists too, in order to track their investments and determine how to wed their children so as to keep the wealth within the family. A yeoman like Roger Goodspeed couldn't afford to hire a professional London genealogist. Judging from the R he wrote for his signature, He probably couldn't have read a genealogist's report anyway. Nevertheless, Roger probably carried family stories in his mind from England to America, where he transmitted them to his children. They told his grandchildren in turn. Roger Goodspeed's stories probably all took place within a few miles of his birthplace in Wingrave, since people in earlier generations had rarely moved far from their home villages. To travel more than 3,000 miles from home in the 1630s, as Roger did, was a radical dislocation. It dropped the Atlantic between him and the wellspring of his stories. In later years, as the Goodspeed family tree branched across the colonies, those old stories grew blurry. Cousins were forgotten. Myths took over. By the 1700s, some American families were already trying to anchor their genealogy back to Europe. In 1771, Thomas Jefferson wrote to an acquaintance preparing to sail for London, asking if he could research the Jefferson coat of arms. "I have what I have been told were the family arms, but on what authority I know not," Jefferson complained. Another founding father, Benjamin Franklin, traveled in 1758 to the English village of Ecton, where the Franklin family had lived for centuries. Determined to uncover his genealogy, he perused the parish registers, inspected the moss-covered gravestones of his ancestors, and chatted with the rector's wife about the Franklin family. The rector later sent him a hand-drawn family tree stretching back to 1563. "I am the youngest son of the youngest son of the youngest son of the youngest son for five generations," Franklin wrote to a cousin, "whereby I find that had there originally been any estate in the family, none could have stood a worse chance of it." Yet Franklin also came away from his research convinced that he inherited the temperament of his ancestors, "for which double blessing I desire to be ever thankful." Franklin and Jefferson helped forge a new country that rejected the ancient power of heredity. "One of the strongest natural proofs of the folly of the hereditary rights of kings is that nature disproves it," Thomas Paine declared in Common Sense. "Kings often turned out unfit to rule," Paine observed, "as if nature produced an ass instead of a lion." Yet the Revolutionary War did not destroy heredity's allure. Old colonial families tried to cling to their high status in the new republic by flaunting their European origins. They put coats of arms on their silverware, their hearses, and their gravestones. Newly rich bourgeois families used genealogy to buy some respectability of their own. Some spent time and money doing research or hiring one of America's new professional genealogists to do their work for them, uncovering connections to aristocracy and supplying coats of arms, even if their newfound heraldry often turned out to be fake. Families of lesser means kept track of their families as well, sewing needlepoint genealogical trees and writing names in family Bibles. If they couldn't prove they inherited noble blood, at the very least they could feel some pride in virtuous blood. In the early 1800s, a Massachusetts woman named Electa Fidelia Jones investigated her roots, celebrating the Puritan blood that ran through her like a magnetic wire, vibrating two centuries later with a message for anyone who could appreciate it. She was thrilled to discover some of her fourth cousins through her research. The find was a better inheritance than any ancient fortune, she said. But other kin did not please Jones. She uncovered a female relative and her husband from the 1750s who were so near idiocy that it was said at the time of their marriage that laws ought to be enacted to prevent the marriage of those so unfit to sustain the relations which they assumed. Among the children this unfit couple had, Jones complained, some were so low in the scale of being that I do not wish to make their acquaintance so far as to ask after their name and age. As she drew her family tree, Jones left those branches hidden. Undistracted by her disreputable kin, she could spend her time dreaming of visiting her Puritan ancestors. "I love to go back in imagination to those old firesides," she said. While Americans eliminated embarrassing relatives from their genealogies, they also tried to link themselves to famous figures. John Randolph, an early U.S. senator from Virginia, boasted that he was a direct descendant of Pocahontas. Shortly before he died in 1833, he regaled a visitor with a detailed account of his genealogy that took him all the way back to William the Conqueror. Tracing his ancestry to a king didn't mean Randolph could inherit the throne of England, but it did let him enjoy a little rubbed-off glory. Randolph's obsession endures today. Every April, a few dozen people gather in a Washington, D.C. club for the annual dinner and meeting of the Order of the Crown of Charlemagne in the United States of America. To be invited to dinner, people must prove that they are direct descendants of the 8th century ruler of the Holy Roman Empire. To make the task easier for Charlemagne's descendants, the order will be satisfied if you can just link your genealogy to someone on their list of gateway ancestors, such as James Claypool of Philadelphia and Agatha Wormley of Virginia. On its website, charlemagne.org, the order declares that its objective is to maintain and promote the traditions of chivalry and knighthood. By the mid-1800s, the search for celebrity, nobility, and virtue had turned American genealogy into a full-blown industry. Guilds formed, publishing official journals of their research. Ralph Waldo Emerson found the new enterprise decidedly un-American. It was a turn to the past in a country that should have been looking toward the future. "When I talked to a genealogist," Emerson wrote in his journal in 1855, "I seemed to sit up with a corpse." Some of the ships that sailed into Massachusetts Bay in the 1630s were delivering settlers from England, including my own ancestor Roger Goodspeed. But in 1638, a ship called the Desire arrived from the West Indies, carrying passengers from another land. The governor of Massachusetts, John Winthrop, recorded the ship's contents: some cotton and tobacco and Negroes, etc. The Desire delivered the first recorded shipment of African slaves to New England. Unlike Roger Goodspeed, the men and women stowed in the Desire would not pass down their goods to their children, or even their names. In their new home, American slaves sustained their genealogies as best they could by telling their children about their ancestors, but much was lost. The abolitionist Frederick Douglass, born in 1818, lived his first 7 years with his maternal grandparents. He never learned much more about his ancestry. Without any records of families, marriages, births, or deaths, such knowledge was impossible to gain. "Genealogical trees do not flourish among slaves," Douglass later wrote. As some slaves gained their freedom, they began to sketch trees. Henry Highland Garnet's family escaped from slavery when he was 9. He went on to become a prominent abolitionist minister and served as U.S. minister to Liberia. Garnet's ancestors had been slaves for generations, but he once said that his great-grandfather was the son of an African chief, stolen from his native country in his youth and sold into slavery on the shores of Maryland. Garnet was part of an elite layer of 19th-century African-American society, made up of college-educated professionals, ministers, doctors, government workers, who developed an interest in genealogy as keen as that of their white counterparts. They also used it to celebrate their superiority. The poet Langston Hughes first encountered this obsession when he moved to Washington, D.C. in 1924 at age 22. He lived there with his cousins, who belonged to the more intellectual and high-class branch of our family, Hughes wrote. Hughes's cousins introduced him to the best colored society, and in those circles, Hughes was both exasperated and amused to hear people boast that they descended from the leading southern white families on the colored side, which, Hughes observed, of course meant the illegitimate side. Eventually, Hughes got so sick of high society that he began spending most of his time on 7th Street, where the ordinary Negroes hang out, folks with practically no family tree at all. But just because the people on 7th Street didn't have a family tree didn't mean they didn't want one. And as the civil rights movement gained strength over the course of the 20th century, some African Americans tried to reclaim their ancestry with genealogy. They had to travel a far rougher trail than their white counterparts. Slaves did not leave wills. They were listed in them, alongside oxen and pewter. Some of the branches of African American family trees led to white planters who raped their female slaves, usually without acknowledging their paternity. The erasure of African genealogy reached down all the way to their names. In 1679, a New York mariner named John Leggett bequeathed to his son a Negro boy, known by the name of U-Boy. When the journalist Alex Haley was growing up in 1920s Tennessee, he would listen to his older female relatives talk about their slave ancestors. As they spat tobacco off their porch, they told him stories that reached all the way back to Haley's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, whom his grandmother simply called the African. The African was captured and shipped to the American colonies, where he was sold to a Virginia planter and renamed Toby. But he demanded to be called Kinte. The old women would sometimes recite a few African words to Haley that Kinte had taught the family, their meaning now lost. Playing with his friends, both black and white, Haley would recount the stories. When the parents of his white friends got wind of his tales of whippings and beatings, they disappeared. Those stories stayed with Haley for years, through college and a career in the Coast Guard,